an amazingly well-camouflaged airfield for interceptors in the woods just outside the capital. The little black automobile, a Russian M1 that looked and sounded much like a 1930 Ford, made cramped quarters, especially with unexplained packages and boxes lining the floor. When they had gone about 100 miles, their guide, a mild-faced, bespectacled tank colonel with the odd name of Porfiry Amfiteatrov, suggested that they stop to eat lunch and stretch their legs. That was when they first heard the German guns. The driver, a burly, silent soldier with a close-trimmed red beard, turned off to a side road lined with old trees. They wound among cleared fields and copses of birch, glimpsing two large white country houses in the distance, and entered a gloomy lane that came to a dead end in wild woods. Here they got out, and the colonel led them along a footpath to a small grassy mound under the trees, where garlands of fresh flowers lay.
"Well, this was Tolstoy's country estate, you know," said Amfiteatrov. "It is called Yasnaya Polyana, and there is his grave. Since it was on the way, I thought you might be interested."
Tudsbury stared at the low mound and spoke in a hushed way not usual to him.
"The grave of Tolstoy? No tomb? No stone?"
"He ordered it so. Put me in the earth," he said, "in the woods where I played green stick with my brother Nicholas when we were boys."
Amfiteatrov's bass voice sounded coarse and loud over the dripping of water through the yellow leaves. Victor Henry cocked his head and glanced at the colonel, for he heard a new noise, soft, irregular thumps, faint as the plop of the rain on the grass. The colonel nodded.
"Well, when the wind is right, the sound carries quite far."
"Ah, guns," said Tudsbury, with a show of great calm.
"Yes, guns. Well, shall we have a bite? The house where he worked is interesting, but it is not open nowadays."
The bearded driver brought the lunch to benches out of sight of the burial spot. They ate black bread, very garlicky sausages, and raw cucumbers, washed down with warm beer. Nobody spoke. The rain dripped, the army trucks murmured on the highway, and the distant guns thumped faintly. Pamela broke the silence.
"Who put the flowers there?"
"The caretakers, I suppose," said the colonel.
"The Germans must never get this far," she said.
"Well, that's a spiritual thought," the colonel said. "I don't think they will, but Yasnaya Polyana is not a strong point, and so the great Tolstoy must now take his chances with the rest of the Russians."
He smiled, suddenly showing red gums and not looking mild at all.
"Anyway, the Germans can't kill him."
Tudsbury said,
"They should have read him a little more carefully."
"We still have to prove that, but we will."
The sun momentarily broke through and birds began to sing. Victor Henry and Pamela Tudsbury sat together on a bench, and light shafted theatrically through the yellow leaves, full on the girl. She wore gray slacks tucked into white fur snow boots and a gray lamb coat and hat.
"Why are you staring at me, Victor?"
"Pam, I've never visited Tolstoy's grave before, certainly not with you. But I swear I remember all this, and most of all the nice way you've got that hat tilted." As her hand went up to her hat, he added, "And I could have told you you'd lift that hand, and the sun would make your ring sparkle." She held out her fingers stiffly, looking at the diamond.
"Ted and I had a bit of a spat about that. When he produced it, I wasn't quite ready to wear it."
The colonel called,
"Well, Captain, I think we go on."
Edging into the thickening traffic stream on the main road, the little black automobile rolled in the direction of the gunfire. Trucks filled the highway, one line moving toward the front, one returning. Whiskered men and stout, sunburned women, working in fields between stretches of birch forest, paid no attention to the traffic. Children playing near the highway ignored the war vehicles, too. In tiny villages, washing hung outside the log cabins and the wooden houses with gaily painted window frames. One odd observation forced itself on Victor Henry. The further one got from Moscow, the nearer to the front, the more normal and peaceful Russia appeared. The capital behind them was one vast, apprehensive scurry. Directly outside it, battalions of women, boys, and scrawny men with glasses, clerks, journalists, and schoolteachers, had been frantically digging anti-tank ditches and planting concrete and steel obstacles in myriads. Beyond that belt of defense began tranquil forests and fields, with fall colors splashing the stretches of green conifer. Mainly the air raid shelters for trucks along the highway, cleared spaces in the woods, masked with cut evergreen boughs, showed there was an invasion on. Toward evening, the car rolled into a small town and stopped at a yellow frame house on a muddy square. Here, red-cheeked children lined up at a pump with pails. Smoke was rising from chimneys. Other children were driving in goats and cows from broad fields, stretching far and flat under a purpling, cloudy sky. And three burly old men were hammering and sawing at the raw frame of a new, unfinished house. This was the strangest thing Pug saw all that day. These Russian ancients, building a house in the twilight, within earshot of German artillery. Much louder here than at the Tolstoy estate, with yellow flashes flickering like summer lightning on the western horizon.
"Well, this is their home," the tank colonel replied when Victor Henry remarked on the sight, as they climbed stiffly out of the car. "Where should they go? We have the Germans stopped here. Of course, we took out the pregnant women and the mothers with babies long ago."
In the warm little dining room of the house, now a regiment headquarters, the visitors crowded around the table with the tank colonel, four officers of the regiment, and a General Yevlenko, who wore three khaki stars on his thick, wide shoulders. He was the chief of staff of the army group in that sector, and Colonel Amfiteatrov told Victor Henry that he had just happened to be passing through the town. This huge man, with fair hair, a bulbous peasant nose, and big smooth pink jaws, appeared to fill one end of the narrow smoky room. Much taken with Pamela, Yevlenko kept passing gallant compliments and urging food and drink on her. His fleshy face at moments settled into an abstracted, stony, deeply sad and tired look. Then it would kindle with jollity, though the eyes remained filmed by fatigue, in sunken purple sockets. A feast almost in Kremlin style appeared, on the rough yellow cloth, course by course, brought by soldiers. Champagne, caviar, smoked fish, soup, fowls, steaks, and cream cakes. The mystery of this magnificent stunt was cleared up when Pug Henry glanced into the kitchen as one of the soldier waiters opened and closed the door. The red-bearded driver of the M1 automobile was sweating over the stove in a white apron. Pug had seen him carrying boxes from the car into the house. Evidently, he was really a cook, and a superb one. The general talked freely about the war, and the colonel translated. His army group was outnumbered in this sector, and had far fewer tanks and guns than the Nazis. Still, they might yet surprise Fritz. They had to hold a line much too long for their strength, according to doctrine. But a good doctrine, like a good regiment, sometimes had to stretch. The Germans were taking fearful losses. He reeled off many figures of tanks destroyed, guns captured, men killed. Any army could advance if its commanders were willing to leave blood smeared on each yard of earth gained. The Germans were getting white as turnips with the bloodletting. This drive was their last big effort to win the war before winter came.
"Will they take Moscow?" Tudsbury asked. "Not from this direction," retorted the general. "Nor do I think they will from any other. But if they do take it, well, we'll drive them out of Moscow, and then we'll drive them out of our land. We are going to beat them. The Germans have no strategic policy. Their idea of a strategic policy is to kill, to loot, and to take slaves. In this day and age, that is not a strategic policy. Furthermore, their resources are basically inferior to ours. Germany is a poor country. Finally, they overestimated themselves and they underrated us. According to V.I. Lenin, that is a very dangerous mistake in war. It is very dangerous in war, Lenin said, to think too much of yourself and too little of your opponent. The result can only be inaccurate plans and very unpleasant surprises, as, for example, defeat.
Pamela said, "Still, they have come so far." The general turned a suddenly menacing, brutally tough, piteously exhausted, angry big face to her. His expression dissolved into a flirtatious smirk.
"Yes, my dear girl, and I see that you mean that remark well and do not like what has happened any more than we do. Yes, the Nazis, through unparalleled perfidy, did achieve surprise. And there is another thing. They are cocky. Their tails are up. They are professional winners, having already won several campaigns and driven the indomitable British into the sea and so forth. They believe they are unbeatable. However, as they watch their comrades die like flies in Russia, I think they are starting to wonder. At first, they would advance in column down our highways, not even bothering to guard their flanks. Lately, they've grown more careful. Yes, Hitler trained them to maraud, kill, and loot, and those are old Teutonic customs, so they are good at it. We are a peace-loving people, and I suppose in a mental sense we were caught unprepared. So, as you say, they have come far. Now we have two jobs, to keep them from coming farther, and then to send them back where they came from, the ones we haven't squashed into our mud.
He turned to Henry and Tudsbury.
We will do the job faster, naturally, if you help us with supplies, for we have lost a lot. But, most of all, the opening of a front in Western Europe can lead to the quick destruction of these rats. The English might be surprised to find they could march straight to Berlin once they set foot in France. I believe every German who can shoot a gun straight has been shipped here for this attack.
I never broadcast without advocating a second front now, Tudsbury said.
The general nodded.
You are well known and esteemed as a friend of the Soviet people.
He glanced at Victor Henry.
Well, and what are you interested in seeing, Captain? Unfortunately, this far inland, we cannot show you very good naval maneuvers.
General, suppose, of course this is absurd, but suppose my president could visit your front in a cloak of invisibility from the fairy tales.
We have such stories, Yevlenko said, but unfortunately no such cloaks.
What would you like him to see? The general glanced at the four officers sitting elbow to elbow at the table across from the visitors, smoking continuously, four kinky-haired, pale Russians with shrewd, weary eyes, who looked like quadruplets in their identical brown tunics. None of them had, as yet, uttered a word. Now he addressed them, and a colloquy in rapid Russian broke out. He turned back to Henry.
You put that well. It will be arranged.
As the situation is a bit fluid, I suggest you make a start at dawn."
He said to Pamela, gesturing upward,
"A bedroom has been cleared for you. The gentleman will bunk with these officers."
"Good heavens, a bedroom! I counted on sleeping on the floor or on the ground in my clothes," Pamela said. "Anyway, I'm not at all sleepy yet."
As the colonel translated, Yevlenko's face lit up.
"So you talk like one of our Russian girls, not like a delicate Englishwoman."
Offering her his arm, he led them into the next room, where worn, inked-over maps hung on the walls, and the fusty house furniture was jumbled in with desks, stools, typewriters, and black twisting telephone cables. Soldiers pushed furniture, screeching here and there, to clear a space around a shabby upright piano with bare wooden keys. An officer sat, cigarette dangling from his mouth, and thumped out, "There'll Always Be an England." Pamela laughed when she recognized the tune and stood and sang it. The general led applause and called for more champagne. The pianist began stumbling through Alexander's ragtime band. With an elegant low bow, General Yevlenko invited Pamela to dance. He towered head and shoulders above her, so they made a grotesque pair, two-stepping stiffly round and round the narrow, clear space in heavy, muddy boots. But his face shone with enjoyment. She danced with other officers, then with the general again, as the pianist ran through the few American tunes he knew and started over on Alexander's ragtime band. Everybody in the room quaffed much champagne and vodka. In the doorway, soldiers crowded, watching with round, gay eyes the foreign lady in gray pants dancing and drinking with the officers. Pug knew that she hated to dance, especially with strangers. He recalled almost the first words he had heard Pamela utter on the Bremen in the dim, far past of peacetime. "I shall get myself a cane and a white wig." But she made a game show. The pianist began playing Russian music, which he did much better, and Pamela sank into a chair while the officers danced alone or with each other. The laughing and the hand-clapping grew louder. One handsome young soldier with a week's growth of beard burst into the room and did a bravura solo, bounding, squatting, pirouetting, then acknowledging applause with the bow of a professional ballet artist. The general lumbered to his feet and began to dance by himself. He too twirled, jumped, then folded his arms and squatted, kicking his feet and hoarsely shouting,
"Skorye, skorye, faster, faster!"
His heavy steps shook the floor. The soldiers broke into the room to ring him and to cheer. The room reeked of men's dirty bodies, of smoke, of alcohol, yet pressed beside Pamela, Victor Henry could faintly smell her carnation perfume, too. When General Yevlenko finished with a shout and jumped up panting, the men roared and clapped, and Pamela came and kissed his perspiring big red face, and he heartily kissed her mouth, causing laughter and more roars, and that was the end. The general left. The soldiers pushed the furniture back as it had been. The visitors went to sleep. Chapter 54. At dawn, it was raining hard. Children and animals floundered in the dim violet light all over the square, and trucks splashed, skidded, and spun their wheels, throwing up curtains of muck. The back seat of the car was roomier, since many of the packages had been eaten or drunk up. Victor Henry thought of complimenting the master chef at the wheel, but decided against it. Pamela, squeezed between her father and Pug, had managed a touch of lipstick and eye makeup. In these surroundings, she looked like a movie star visiting the troops, Pug thought.
"Well, we go," said Colonel Amfiteatrov. "In this weather we will go slower and not so far."
The car bumped and slid about 100 yards,
then sank and stalled.
"Well, I hope we will go farther than this," said the colonel.
Soldiers in greatcoats surrounded the car. With shouting and shoving, they got it to move. The wheels hit solider ground, and the car went splashing, rocking, and slewing out of the town. After a run on asphalted highway through the fields, they took a narrow mud road into a forest. The chef drove well, or the chauffeur cooked well, Pug never did find out the truth, and he kept the car going through terrible ruts, mounds, and holes for perhaps 20 minutes. Then the car stopped dead. Pug got out with the driver and the colonel. The hubs of the rear wheels were buried in ropey red mud. It was still raining heavily. They were stuck in wild woods, so quiet that rain hitting the hot hood made a hiss.
"I suppose he has a shovel," Pug said.
"Yes, I suppose so."
The colonel was looking around. He walked off into the woods some yards ahead, to relieve himself, Pug imagined, before getting to work. Pug heard voices, then hoarse engine snorts. The bushes began to move. Out of the shrubbery, a light tank appeared, covered with boughs, its cannon pointed at Pug. Behind it walked the colonel and three muddy men in greatcoats. The American had been looking straight at the mottled, camouflaged cannon, yet had not noticed it until it started toward him. The tank chugged out of the trees, swerved, and backed on the road. Soldiers quickly attached a chain, and the car was pulled loose in a moment, with the passengers inside. Then the bow-festooned turret opened, and two bristly, boyish Slav heads poked out. Pamela jumped from the car, splashed and tumbled to the tank, and kissed the tankists, to their embarrassed pleasure. The turret closed, the tank backed into the wood to its former place, and the black automobile went lurching on into the forest. Thus they were bogged and rescued several times, and so discovered that the wet, silent forest was swarming with the Red Army. They arrived at a washout that severed the road like a creek in flood. The gully's sides bore gouge marks of caterpillar treads and thick truck tires, but obviously the auto could not struggle across. Here, soldiers emerged from the woods and laid split logs across the gash, smooth side up, lashing them together into a shaky but adequate bridge. This was a sizable crew, and their leader, a fat, squinting lieutenant, invited the party to stop and refresh themselves. There was no way of telling him from his men, except that he gave the orders and they obeyed. They were all dressed alike, and they were all a red earth color. He led the visitors through the trees and down into an icy, mucky dugout roofed with timbers, and so masked by brush and shrubs that Victor Henry did not see an entrance until the officer began to sink into the earth. The dugout was an underground cabin of tarred logs, crisscrossed with telephone cables, lit by an oil lamp and heated by an old open iron stove burning chopped branches. The officer, squinting proudly at a brass samovar on the raw plank table, offered them tea. While water boiled, a soldier conducted the men to a latrine so primitive and foul, though Tudsbury and the Russians happily used it, that Pug went stumbling off into the trees, only to be halted by a sentry who appeared like a forest spirit. While the American attended to nature, the soldier stood guard, observing with some interest how a foreigner did it. Returning to the dugout, Pug encountered three big, blank-faced Russians, marching with fixed bayonets around Pamela, who looked vaguely embarrassed and amused. Before they left, the lieutenant showed Pug and Tudsbury through the soldiers' dugouts, obviously proud of his men's workmanship. These freshly dug, puddle-filled holes in the damp earth, smelling like graves, did have heavy timbered roofs that might survive a shell hit, and the mud-caked, unshaven soldiers
crouched in their great coats in the gloom, appeared content enough to smoke and talk and wait for orders here. Pug saw some feeding themselves with torn chunks of gray bread and dollops of stew from a muddy tureen lugged by two muddy soldiers. Munching on their bread, dragging at their cigarettes, these men placidly stared at the visitors and slowly moved their heads to watch them walk through the trenches. Healthy-looking, well-nourished, they seemed as much at home in the red earth as earthworms, and they seemed almost as tough, abundant, and simple a form of life. Here Victor Henry first got an ineradicable feeling that Yevlenko had told the truth, that the Germans might gain the biggest victories, but that the Red Army would, in time, drive them out.
"Ye gods!" Tudsbury managed to mutter on the way back to the car. "Belgium in 1915 was nothing like this. They live like animals."
"They can," Henry replied, and said no more, for Amfiteatrov's eye was on them in these brief asides.
"Well, we are not really far from our destination," the Russian said, wiping rain from his face and helping Pamela into the back seat. "If not for the mud, we would have been there now."
The car bumped and slopped out of the woods. Cleared fields stretched for miles ahead, flat as a table, under gray low clouds.
"There's where we're going."
Amfiteatrov pointed straight ahead to a distant line of forest. They came to a crossroads of mud churned up like water at a boil, and though the road ahead looked good, the driver slithered the car sharp right. "Why don't we drive straight on?" Pamela said. "Doesn't the road go through?"
"Oh, yes, it goes through. It's mined. This whole area,"
the colonel's arm swept around the quiet, stubbly fields,
"is mined."
Pug said, somewhat chilled, "Nice to know these things when you start out." Amfiteatrov gave him his infrequent, wolfish, red-gummed smile and wiped a clear drop from his thin, bluish nose.
"Well, yes, Captain. Your in-tourist guide in these parts should really know what is what. Otherwise, your health could be affected."
They jolted along the soupy track in rain that made it soupier, but in time the car sank with all four wheels into the mire and halted amid long rows of yellow stubble stretching out of sight. No rescuers appeared. They could not have, without rising from the earth, but Pug half thought they might. The driver shoveled the wheels clear and laid planks to the back tires. When the passengers got out to lighten the car, Amfiteatrov warned them to stay in the road, for mines were planted everywhere under the stubble. Showering muck and splinters all over them, the car lurched free. On they went. Pug gave up trying to guess the direction. They never passed a road marker or signpost. The low gray clouds showed no sun patch. In the forest of the earthworm soldiers, the artillery thumps had been fainter than in the village. Here they were considerably louder. But zigzags in the front line could cause that. Obviously, they had stopped going west, because westward were the Germans. The car appeared to be meandering 5 miles or so behind the fire zone.
"Here we will go a bit out of the way,"
the tank colonel said at another crossroads.
"But you will see something interesting."
They entered fields where tall yellow-green stalks of grain stood unharvested and rotting. After a mile or so, Amfiteatrov told the driver to stop.
"Perhaps you won't mind stretching your legs," he said. "You all have nice, thick boots."
He gave Pamela an odd look.
"But you might find this walk boring. Perhaps you will stay with the driver here."
"I'll come unless you tell me to stay."
"Very well, come."
They went pushing in among the stalks. The wet, quiet field of overripe grain smelled sweet, almost like an orchard. But the visitors, squelching along behind Amfiteatrov in a file, soon glanced at each other in revulsion as a rotten stench hit their noses. They broke into a clear space and saw why. They were looking at a battlefield. In every direction, the grain was crushed flat in great crisscrossing swathes of brown muck. Random patches of stalks still stood, and amid the long brown slashes and the green-yellow clumps, damaged tanks lay scattered on their sides, or turned clear over, or canted, their camouflage paint blistered and burned black, their caterpillar tracks torn, their armor plate blown open. Seven of the tanks bore German markings. Two were light Russian T-26 tanks, such as Pug had often seen moving through Moscow. The stink rose from German corpses, sprawled in green uniforms here and there on the ground, and others slumped in blown-open tanks. Their dead purple faces were bloated disgustingly and covered with fat black flies, but one could see that they had been youngsters. Pamela turned pale and clapped a handkerchief to her face.
"Well, I am sorry," said the colonel, an ugly gleam lighting his face. "This happened only day before yesterday. These Fritzes were probing and got caught. Their comrades went away from here and wouldn't stop to dig proper graves, being in a slight hurry."
Helmets, papers, and broken bottles were littered among the tanks and the corpses, and the oddest sight was a mess of women's underwear, pink, blue, and white drawers and petticoats, heaped, soiled, and sodden in the mud near an overturned tank. Pamela, eyebrows rising over the handkerchief, pointed to these.
"Well, funny, isn't it? I suppose Fritz stole those from a village. The Germans steal everything they can lay their hands on. That is why they have come into our country, after all, to steal. We had a tough tank fight around Vyazma a month ago. One tank we blew up had a large, fine marble clock in it, and also a dead pig. The fire ruined that pig. That was a pity. It was a very good pig. Well, I thought this might interest you."
Pictures of knocked-out panzers were common in Moscow, but before this, Victor Henry had seen actual German tanks only in Berlin, clanking down boulevards lined with red swastika flags to the blare of brass band marches over the loudspeakers and the hurrahs of crowds giving Nazi salutes. Or else massed factory fresh on trains of flat cars, chugging to the front. Seeing a few broken and overturned in a desolate Russian cornfield 2,000 miles from Berlin, with their crewmen rotting beside them in the mud, was a hard jolt. He said to the tank colonel,
"Aren't these Mark III's? How could your T-26s knock them out? They don't fire a shell that can penetrate the Mark III."
Amfiteatrov grinned.
"Well, very good. For a seaman, you know a bit about tank warfare. But you had better ask the battalion commander who won this battle. So, let us be on our way."
They backtracked to the crossroads, headed toward the forest, and arrived at what looked like an open-air machine shop for tank repairs, in a village of a dozen or so thatched log cabins straggling along the road through wild woods. Detached caterpillar tracks stretched long and straight on the ground under the trees. Bogey wheels were off. Guns were off. And on every side, men in black or blue coveralls hammered, filed, greased, and welded, shouting in Russian and laughing at each other. Strolling down the street in an olive-colored greatcoat too large for him, a short, hook-nosed, swarthy officer broke into a trot when he saw the black automobile. He saluted the colonel, then the two embraced and kissed. Introducing the visitors, Amfiteatrov said,
"Major Kaplan, I showed our friends those busted German tanks out there.
Our American Navy friend asked a real tankist's question. He asked, how could T-26s knock out Panzer Mark III's?
The battalion commander grinned from ear to ear, clapped Victor Henry on the back, and said in Russian,
good, come this way.
Beyond the last cabin, he led them into the woods, past two lines of light tanks ranged under the trees and draped with camouflage netting over their own green and sand blotches.
Here we are, he said proudly. This is how we knocked out the Mark III's.
Dispersed in the thickets, all but invisible under branches and nets, five armored monsters thrust heavy square turrets with giant guns high in the air. Tudsbury's mouth fell open as he stared up at them. He nervously brushed his mustaches with a knuckle.
My God! What are these things?
Our newest Russian tank, said Amfiteatrov. General Yevlenko thought it might interest President Roosevelt.
Fantastic, said Talky. Why, I'd heard you'd had these monsters, but what do they weigh? 100 tons? Look at that gun!
The Russians smiled at each other. Amfiteatrov said,
it's a good tank.
Tudsbury asked if they might climb inside one, and to Pug's surprise, the colonel agreed. Young tankists helped the lame, fat Englishman to the hatch as Pug scrambled up. Inside the command turret, despite the clutter of machinery and instruments and the bulky gun breech, there was a lot of elbow room. The machine smelled startlingly like a new car. Pug guessed this came from the heavy leather seats for the gunner and the commander. He knew very little about tanks, but the workmanship of the raw metal interior seemed good, despite some crude instrument brackets and wiring. The dials, valves, and controls had an old-fashioned German look.
Great God, Henry! It's a land battleship, Tudsbury said. When I think of the tiny tin cans we rode in, why, the best German tanks today are eggshells to this. Bloody eggshells! What a surprise!
When they climbed out, soldiers were clustering around the tank, perhaps 100 or more, with others coming through the trees. On the flat hull stood Pamela, embarrassed and amused under the male stares. Bundled in mud-caked lambskin, Pamela was not a glamorous object, but her presence seemed to thrill and hypnotize the tankists. A pale, moon-faced officer with glasses and long yellow teeth stood beside her. Major Kaplan introduced him as the political officer.
"The Commissar would like to present all of you to the troops," said Amfiteatrov to Victor Henry, "as he feels this visit is a serious occasion that can be used to bolster their fighting spirit."
"By all means," Victor Henry said.
He could understand only fragments of the strident, quick-tumbling harangue of the moon-faced commissar, but the earnest tones, the waving fist, the communist slogans, the innocent, attentive faces of the handsome young tankists made a clear enough picture. The commissar's speech was half a revivalist sermon and half a football coach's pep talk. Suddenly the soldiers applauded, and Amfiteatrov began to translate, in bursts of 3 or 4 sentences at a time, during which the moon face beamed at him.
"In the name of the Red Army, I now welcome the American naval captain, Genry, the British war correspondent, Tudsbury, and especially the brave English newspaper woman, Pamela, to our front. It is always good for a fighting man's morale to see a pretty face."
Laughter among the men.
"But we have no evil thoughts, Miss Tudsbury. We think only of our own little sweethearts back home, naturally. Besides, your father has wisely come along to protect you from the romantic and virile young Russian tankists."
laughter, and hand claps.
"You have showed us that the British and American peoples have not forgotten us in our struggle against the fascist hyenas. Comrade Stalin has said that the side which has more petroleum engines will win this war. Why is the petroleum engine so important? Because petroleum is the biggest source of energy today, and energy wins wars. We tankists know that. Hitler and the Germans thought they would make a lot of petroleum engines in a hurry, put them in tanks and aircraft, and steal a march on the world. Hitler even hoped that certain ruling circles in America and England would help him once he decided to attack the peaceful Soviet people. Well, he miscalculated. These two great nations have formed an unshakable front with the Soviet peoples. That is what the presence of our visitors shows us. We three countries possess many more petroleum engines than the Germans, and since we can manufacture still more engines faster than they can, because we have much larger industries, we will win this war. We will win it faster if our friends will hasten to send us plentiful war supplies, because the Nazi bandits will not quit until we have killed a great many of them. Above all, we will win much faster if our British allies will open a second front at once and kill some German soldiers too. Certain people think it is impossible to beat Germans. So, let me ask this battalion. Have you fought Germans?
Twilight had fallen during the harangue, and Pug could barely see the nearest soldiers' faces. A roar came from the darkness.
Da! Have you beaten them?
Da!
Are you afraid of Germans?
Niet!
And barking male laughter.
Do you think the British should be afraid to open a second front against them?
Niet!
And more laughter, and another bellow, like a college cheer in Russian.
Second front now! Second front now!
Thank you, my comrades. And now to dinner, and then back to our tanks, in which we have won many victories, and will win more. For our socialist motherland, our sweethearts, our mothers, our wives, and our children, and for Comrade Stalin.
A tremendous college cheer in the gloom.
We serve the Soviet Union! The meeting is over,
hoarsely cried the Commissar, as the moon rose over the trees. Pug came awake from restless sleep on a straw pallet on the dirt floor of a log cabin. Beside him, in blackness, Talky Tudsbury liquidly snored. Groping for a cigarette and lighting it, he saw Pamela as the match flared upright on the only bed, her back to the plastered log wall, her eyes glittering.
Pam?
Hello there. I still feel as though we're bumping and sliding in mud. Do you suppose if I stepped outside, the sentry would shoot me?
Let's try. I'll step out first. If I get shot, you go back to bed.
Oh, that's a fine plan. Thank you.
Pug pulled on the cigarette, and in the red glow, Pamela came over and clasped hands. Moving along the rough wall, Pug found the door and opened a blue rectangle in the dark.
I'll be damned. Moon. Stars.
A high moon, partly veiled by swift-rolling clouds, dusted the thatched huts and the rutted, empty road blue-gray. Across the road, in the woods, soldiers were sadly singing to an accordion. Victor Henry and Pamela Tudsbury sat down on a rough bench, hands clasped, huddling close in the frigid wind which blew straight up the road. Underfoot, the mud was ridged hard.
"Dear God," Pamela said, "it's a long, long way to Tipperary, isn't it?"
"Washington, D.C.'s even further."
"Thanks for bringing me out, Victor. I was sitting there, not daring to move. I love the smell of this countryside, but Lord, that wind cuts you.
Yellow flashes ran along the sky, and loud thumps followed fast. Pamela winced against him with a little gasp.
Oh, oh, look at that. Talkie was a pig to drag me out here, wasn't he?
Of course it suits him. He dictated 2 hours by candlelight tonight, and he couldn't have written a line himself. It's quite a story, I'll say that.
Are those tanks as startling as he claims? He says in his last sentence that if the Soviet Union can mass-produce them, the war's as good as over.
Well, that's journalism. Size isn't everything. Any tank, no matter how big, can be an incinerator for crews if it's built wrong. How maneuverable is it? How vulnerable is it? The Germans will find the weak spots. They'll rush out a new gun that can penetrate these things. They're good at that. Still, it's quite a tank.
Count on you,
Pamela laughed.
I think that was why I couldn't sleep. I had this vision of the war coming to a sudden end. It was such a weird, dazzling idea. The Germans beaten, Hitler dead or locked up, the lights going on again in London, the big clean-up, and then life continuing the way it used to be, all because of these monster tanks rolling by the thousands to Berlin. My God, those guns do sound close.
It's a pipe dream, Victor Henry said. The Germans are winning. We're pretty close to Moscow here, Pam.
After a silence, she said, looking up at the moon and stars, and then at Pug's shadowy face,
When you just said those tanks couldn't end the war, do you know what? I felt relieved. Relieved! What kind of mad reaction was that?
Well, the war's something different, while it lasts.
Victor Henry gestured at the angry yellow flare-ups on the black western clouds.
The expensive fireworks, the travel to strange places.
The interesting company, Pamela said.
Yes, Pam, the interesting company.
The accordion was playing alone now, a plaintive tune like a lullaby, half drowned by the cracking and sighing of trees in the wind.
What is that sensation of sudden remembering supposed to mean? She said. The sort of thing you felt yesterday at the Tolstoy place.
Pug said,
Isn't it a kind of short circuit in the brain? Some irrelevant stimulus triggers off the sense of recognition when it shouldn't. So I once read.
On the Bremen, the second day out, said Pamela, I was walking the deck in the morning, and so were you, going the other way. We passed each other twice. It was getting silly. I decided to ask you, next time we passed, to walk with me. And I suddenly knew you'd ask me. I knew the exact words you'd use. You used them. I made a remark about your wife as though I were acting a play, and your answer came like the next line in the play, all old and familiar. I've never forgotten that.
A tall soldier, muffled in his greatcoat, trudged by with smoking breath, the unsheathed bayonet of his rifle glinting in the moonlight. He stopped to glance at them and passed on.
Where are we heading tomorrow, Victor?
I'm going to the front line. You and Talkie will stay in a town several miles back. Up front, one sometimes has to make a dash for it, the colonel says, and of course, Talkie can't do that.
Why must you go?
Well, Amfiteatrov offered. It'll be informative.
This is the flight to Berlin again.
No, I'll be on the ground all the way, on friendly territory. Quite a difference.
How long will you be gone from us?
Just a few hours.
A green radiance blinded them, a sudden blaze filling the heavens. Pamela uttered a cry. As their pupils adjusted to the shock, they saw 4 smoky green lights floating very slowly down below the thickening clouds, and heard the thrum of engines. The sentry had darted off the road. The village showed no sign of life. A tiny, sleeping Russian hamlet of thatched huts in the woods on a mud road, like 100 others, with a stage-setting appearance in the artificial glare.
All the tanks under repair had been camouflaged.
"You look ghastly," Pam said.
"You should see yourself. They're searching for this tank battalion." The lights sank earthward. One turned orange and went out. The airplane sounds faded away. Pug glanced at his watch.
"I used to think the Russians were nutty on camouflage, but it has its points."
He stiffly rose and opened the cabin door.
"We'd better try to sleep."
Pamela put a hand out, palm up to the black sky. The clouds were blotting out the moon and stars.
"I thought I felt something."
She held her hand toward Pug. In the light of the last falling flare, he could see, melting on her palm, a fat snowflake. Chapter 55. The car crossed a white bare plain in a steady snowfall in leaden light. Pug could see no road by which the driver guided the jolting, sliding, shaking machine. What about mines? Trusting that Amfiteatrov had no more appetite than he to get blown up, Pug said nothing. In about an hour, an onion-top belfry of yellow brick loomed ahead through the veil of snow. They entered a town where soldiers milled and army trucks lurched on mud streets between unpainted wood houses. From some trucks, the livid, bloody, bandaged faces of soldiers peered sadly. Villagers, mostly snow-flecked old women and boys, stood in front of the houses, dourly watching the traffic go by. At the steps of the yellow brick church, Pug parted company with the others. A political officer in a belted white leather coat, with the slanted eyes of a Tartar and a little beard like Lenin's, came to take him off in a small British jeep. Talky Tudsbury happily said in Russian, pointing to the trademark,
"Ah, so British aid has reached the front at last."
The political officer replied in ragged English that it required men and gunfire, not automobiles, to stop Germans, and that the British vehicles were not strong enough for heavy duty. Pamela gave Victor Henry a serious, wide-eyed stare. Despite the wear and soil of travel, she looked charming, and the lambskin hat was tilted jauntily on her head.
"Watch yourself," was all she said.
The jeep went west, out of the tumultuous town and into a snow-laden quiet forest. They appeared to be heading straight for the front, yet the only gunfire thumps came from the left, to the south. Pug thought the snow might be muffling the sound up ahead. He saw many newly splintered trees and bomb craters lined with fresh snow. The Germans had been shelling the day before, the commissar said, trying in vain to draw the fire of Russian batteries hidden in the woods. The jeep bounced past some of these batteries. Big, horse-drawn howitzers, tended by weary-looking, bewhiskered soldiers amid evergreens and piles of shells at the ready. They came to a line of crude trenches through the smashed, fallen trees, with high earthworks sugared by snow. These were dummy dugouts, the commissar said, deliberately made highly visible. They had taken much of the shellfire yesterday. The real trenches, a couple of hundred yards further on, had escaped. Dug along a riverbank, their log tops level with the ground and snowed over, the actual trenches were totally invisible. The commissar parked the jeep among trees, and he and Victor Henry crawled the rest of the way through the brush.
"The less movement the Fritzes can observe, the better," said the Russian.
Here, down in a deep, muddy hole, a machine-gun post manned by three soldiers, Victor Henry peered through a gun-slit piled with sandbags and saw Germans. They were working in plain view across the river with earth-moving machines, pontoons, rubber boats, and trucks. Some dug with shovels, some patrolled with light machine guns in hand. Unlike the Russians, concealed like wild creatures in the earth, the Germans were making no effort to hide themselves or what they were doing. Except for the helmets, guns, and long gray coats,
They might have been a big crew on a peacetime construction job. Through binoculars handed him by a soldier, German binoculars, Victor Henry could see the eyeglasses and frost-purpled cheeks and noses of Hitler's chilled men.
"You could shoot them like birds," he said in Russian.
It was as close as he could come to the American idiom, "they're sitting ducks." The soldier grunted.
"Yes, and give away our position and start them shelling us. No thanks, Gospodin American."
"If they ever get that bridge finished," said the commissar, "and start coming across, that'll be time enough to shoot a big dose down their throats."
"That's what we're waiting for,"
said a pipe-smoking soldier with heavy, drooping mustaches, who appeared to be in command of this hole in the ground. Pug said,
"Do you really think you can hold out if they get across?"
The three soldiers rolled their eyes at each other, weighing this question asked in bad Russian by a foreigner. Their mouths set sourly. Here, for the first time, in sight of the Germans, Victor Henry detected fear on Red Army faces.
"Well, if it comes to that," said the pipe smoker, "every man has his time. A Russian soldier knows how to die."
The political officer said briskly,
"A soldier's duty is to live, comrade, not to die, to live and fight. They won't get across. Our big guns are trained on this crossing, and as soon as they've wasted all the time it takes to build a bridge, and they start across, we'll bless these Hitlerite rats. Eh, Polikov, how about it?"
"That's right,"
said a bristle-faced soldier with a runny nose, crouched on the earth in a corner, blowing on his red hands.
"That's exactly right, comrade political officer."
Crawling through bushes or darting from tree to tree, Victor Henry and the commissar made their way along the dugouts, pillboxes, trenches, and one-man posts of the thinly held line. A battalion of 900 men was covering 5 miles of the river here, the commissar said, to deny the Germans access to an important road.
"This campaign is simply a race," he panted,
as they crawled between dugouts.
"The Germans are trying to beat Father Frost into Moscow. That's the plain fact of it. They are pouring out their lifeblood to do it. But never fear. Father Frost is an old friend of Russia. He'll freeze them dead in the ice. You'll see. They'll never make it."
The commissar was evidently on a morale-stiffening mission. Here and there, where they found a jolly leader in a trench, the men seemed ready for the fight. But elsewhere, fatalism darkened their eyes, slumped their shoulders, and showed in dirty weapons, disarrayed uniforms, and garbage-strewn holes. The commissar harangued them, exploiting the strange presence of an American to buck them up. But for the most part, the hairy-faced Slavs stared at Henry with sarcastic incredulity, as though to say, "If you're really an American, why are you so stupid as to come here yourself? We have no choice, worse luck." The Germans were in view all along the river, methodically and calmly preparing to cross. Their businesslike air was more intimidating, Pug thought, than volleys of bullets. Their numbers were alarming, too. Where did they all come from? The commissar and Victor Henry emerged from one of the largest dugouts and lay on their elbows in the snow.
"Well, I have finished my tour of this part of the line, Captain. Perhaps you will rejoin your party now."
"I'm ready."
With a grim little smile, the commissar stumbled to his feet.
"Keep in the shadows of the trees."
When they got back to the jeep, Pug said,
"How far are we from Moscow here?"
"Oh, quite far enough."
The commissar whirred the noisy engine.
"I hope you saw what you wanted to see."
"I saw a lot," Victor Henry said.
The commissar turned his Lenin-like face at the American, appraising him with suspicious eyes.
"It is not easy to understand the front just by looking at it."
"I understand that you need a second front."
The commissar uttered a brutal grunt.
Then you understand the main thing. But even without the second front, if we must, Captain Genry, we ourselves will smash this plague of German cockroaches.
By the time they reached the central square of the town, the snowfall had stopped, and patches of fast-moving blue showed through the clouds. The wind was bitter cold. The tangle of trucks, wagons, horses, and soldiers was worse than before. Vehement Russian cursing and arguing filled the air. The old women and the wrinkle-faced boys still watched the disorder with round, sad eyes. In a big jam of vehicles around two fallen horses and an overturned ammunition wagon, the jeep encountered the black automobile. Talky Tudsbury, in great spirits, stood near 40 yelling soldiers and officers, watching the horses kick and struggle in tangled traces, while other soldiers gathered up long coppery shells that had spilled from burst boxes and lay softly gleaming in the snow.
"Hello there! Back already? What a mess! It's a wonder the whole wagon didn't go up with a bang, what? And leave a hole 100 feet across!"
"Where's Pamela?"
Tudsbury flipped a thumb over his shoulder.
"Back at the church. An artillery spotter is stationed in the belfry. There's supposed to be a great view, but I couldn't climb the damned tower. She's up there making some notes. How are things at the front? You've got to give me the whole picture. What frost, huh? Do you suppose Jerry is starting to feel it in his balls a bit? Oh, hello, they've got the horses up."
Amfiteatrov said he was taking Tudsbury to see a downed Junker 88 in the nearby field. Pug told him that he had seen plenty of Junker 88s. He would join Pam in the church and wait for them. Amfiteatrov made an annoyed face.
"All right, but please remain there, Captain. We'll come back in 20 minutes or less."
Pug said goodbye to the bearded commissar who was sitting at the wheel of the jeep, bellowing at a scrawny soldier who clutched a live white goose. The soldier was coarsely shouting back, and the goose turned its orange beak and little eyes from one to the other as though trying to learn its fate. Making his way around the traffic tangle, Pug walked to the church on crunching, squeaking, dry snow. Freedom from the escort, even for a few minutes, felt strange and good. Inside the church, a strong, unchurch-like miasma of medicine and disinfectant filled the air. Peeling frescoes of blue, big-eyed saints looked down from grimy walls at bandaged soldiers who lay on straw mats, smoking, talking to each other, or sadly staring. The narrow stone staircase spiraling up the inside of the belfry, with no handholds, made Pug queasy, but up he went, edging along the rough wall to a wooden platform level with big rusty bells, where wind gusted through four open brick arches. Here he caught his breath and mounted a shaky wooden ladder.
"Victor!"
As he emerged on the topmost brick walk, Pam waved and called to him. Seen this close, the bulging onion dome was a crude job of tin sheets nailed rustily on a curving frame. Squared around it was a yellow brick walk and parapet, where Pamela crouched in a corner, out of the whistling wind. The artillery spotter, shapeless and faceless in an ankle-length brown coat, mittens, goggles, and fastened-down thick ear flaps, manned giant binoculars on a tripod, pointed west. A fat black tomcat beside Pamela crouched over a bowl of soup, lapping, shaking its big head in distaste, and lapping again. Pamela and the spotter were laughing at the cat.
"Too much pepper, kitty?"
Pamela's gay, flirtatious look showed she clearly was enjoying herself. Below, the bare plain stretched far east and south to distant forests, and west and north to the black, wriggling river and sparse woods. Straight downward, the town, a clot of life, made thin noise in an empty, white, flat world.
"Voy amerikansky officer?"
The spotter showed fine teeth in the hairy, uncovered patch of his face.
Duh.
Posmatritya? The mittened hand tapped the binoculars.
Vidyat Nemtsi?
Pug said. Can you see Germans?
Shlishko mnogo.
Too many.
Odin shlishko mnogo, Pug said.
One is too many. With a grim nod and chuckle, the spotter stepped away from the binoculars. Pug's eyes were watering from the wind. He put them to eyepieces, and the Germans on the riverbank leaped into sight, blurry and small, still at the same work.
"Doesn't it give you an eerie feeling?" Pam said, stroking the cat. "They're so calm about it."
Victor Henry went to a corner of the brick parapet and surveyed the snowy vista through all points of the compass, hands jammed in his blue coat. The spotter, turning the binoculars from south to north, made a slow sweep along the river, talking into a battered telephone on a long black wire that dangled over the parapet.
"Kitty, don't forget behind the ears."
The cat was washing itself, and Pamela scratched its head. Pug told her about his trip, meanwhile scanning the horizon round and round as though he were on a flying bridge. An odd movement in the distant snowy forest caught his notice. With his back to the spotter, he peered intently eastward, shielding his eyes with one chapped red hand.
"Pass me those."
She handed him small field glasses, in an open case beside the binocular stand. One quick look, and Pug tapped the spotter's shoulder and pointed. Swinging the large binoculars halfway round on the tripod, the spotter started with surprise, pulled off goggles and cap, and looked again. He had a lot of curly blonde hair and freckles, and he was only 18 or 20. Snatching up the telephone, he jiggled the hook, talked, jiggled some more, and gestured anger at no answer. Pulling on his cap, he went trampling down the ladder.
"What is it?" Pamela said.
"Take a look."
Pamela saw through the big eyepieces of the spotter's instrument a column of machines coming out of the woods.
"Tanks?"
"Some are trucks and armored personnel cars, but yes, it's a tank unit."
Victor Henry, glasses to his eyes, talked as though he were watching a parade.
"Aren't they Russians?"
"No."
"But that's the direction we came from."
"Yes."
They looked each other in the eyes. Her red-cheeked face showed fear, but also a trace of nervous gaiety.
"Then aren't we in a pickle? Shouldn't we get down out of here and find Amfiteatrov?"
To the naked eye, the armored column was like a tiny black worm on the broad white earth, 5 or 6 miles away. Pug stared eastward, thinking. The possibilities of this sudden turn were too disagreeable to be put into words. He felt a flash of anger at Tudsbury's selfish dragging of his daughter into hazard. Of course, nobody had planned on being surprised in the rear by Germans, but there they were. If the worst came to the worst, he felt he could handle himself with German captors, though there might be ugly moments with soldiers before he could talk to an officer. But the Tudsburys were enemies.
"I'll tell you, Pam," he said, watching the worm pull clear of the forest and move sluggishly toward the town, leaving a black trail behind. "The colonel knows where we are now. Let's stick here for a while."
"All right. How in God's name did the Germans get around back there?"
"Amfiteatrov said there was trouble to the south. They must have broken across the river and hooked through the woods. It's not a large unit. It's a probe."
The top of the ladder danced and banged under a heavy tread. The blonde youngster came up, seized a studimeter, pointed it at the Germans, and slid a vernier back and forth. Hastily flattening out a small black-and-white grid map on one knee, he barked numbers into the telephone.
5.6, 124, R7, M12. That's right, that's right.
Animated and cheery now, he grinned at the visitors.
"Our batteries are training on them. When they're good and close, we'll blow them to bits. So maybe you'll see something yet.
He put on his goggles, changing back from a bright-eyed boy into a faceless, grim spotter. Victor Henry said, "They're watching across the river for your batteries to fire." The spotter clumsily waved both heavy-clad arms.
"Good, but we can't let those bastards take the town from the rear, can we?"
"I hear airplanes." Pug turned his glasses westward to the sky.
"Samolyoty."
"Da."
Swiveling and tilting the binoculars upward, the spotter began to shout into the phone.
"Airplanes, too?" Pamela's voice trembled. "Well, I'm more used to them."
"That's the German drill," said Victor Henry. "Tanks and planes together."
The oncoming planes, three Stukas, were growing bigger in Pug's glasses. The spotter switched his binoculars to the tanks again and began cheering. Pug looked in that direction.
"Holy cow! Now I call this military observing, Pam."
Tanks in another column were coming out of the woods about halfway between the Germans and the town, moving on a course almost at right angles to the panzer track. He handed her the glasses and squinted toward the airplanes.
"Oh, oh!" Pamela exclaimed. "Ours?"
"Da!"
cried the spotter, grinning at her. "Nashi! Nashi!"
A hand struck her shoulder and knocked her to her hands and knees.
"They're starting their dive," Victor Henry said. "Crawl up close to the dome and lie still."
He was on his knees beside her. His cap had fallen off and rolled away, and he brushed black hair from his eyes to watch the planes. They tilted over and dove. When they were not much higher than the belfry, bombs fell out of them. With a mingled engine roar and wind screech, they zoomed by. Pug could see the black crosses, the swastikas, the yellowish plexiglass cockpits. All around the church, the bombs began exploding. The belfry shook. Flame, dirt, and smoke roared up beyond the parapet, but Pug remained clear-headed enough to note that the flying was ragged. The three ungainly black machines almost collided as they climbed and turned to dive again in a reckless tangle. The Luftwaffe had either lost most of its veteran pilots by now, he thought, or they were not flying on this sector of the front. Anti-aircraft guns were starting to pop and rattle in the town. Pamela's hand sought his. She was crouched behind him, against the dome.
"Just lie low. This will be over soon."
As Pug said this, he saw one of the Stukas separating from the others and diving straight for the belfry. He shouted to the spotter, but the airplane noise, the chatter of AA guns, the clamor and cries from the town below, and the roar of the wind quite drowned his voice. Tracers made a red-dotted line to the belfry across the gray sky. The tin dome began to sing to rhythmically striking bullets. Victor Henry roughly pushed Pamela flat and threw himself on top of her. The plane stretched into a sizable black machine approaching through the air. Watching over his shoulder to the last, Victor Henry saw the pilot, dimly, behind his plexiglass, an unhelmeted young blonde fellow with a toothy grin. He thought the youngster was going to crash into the dome, and as he winced, he felt something rip at his left shoulder. The airplane's scream and roar and whiz mounted, went past, and diminished. The zinging and rattling of bullets stopped. Pug stood, feeling his shoulder. His sleeve was torn open at the very top, and the shoulder board was dangling, but there was no blood. The spotter was lying on the bricks beside the overturned binoculars. Bombs were exploding below. The other two planes were still whistling and roaring over the town. One plane was smoking badly. Blood was pooling under the spotter's head, and with horror, Pug perceived white, broken bone of the skull showing through the torn, shot-away cap, under blonde hair and thick-moving red and gray ooze. Pug went to the spotter and cautiously moved his goggles. The blue eyes were open, fixed, and empty. The head wound was catastrophic.
Picking up the telephone, Pug jiggled the hook till somebody answered. He shouted in Russian, "I'm the American visitor up here, you understand?" He saw the smoking plane, which was trying to climb, burst into flames and fall.
"Da, where is Konstantin?"
The voice sounded exhilarated. "Airplane killed him."
"All right, somebody else will come."
Pamela had crawled beside the spotter and was looking at the dead face and smashed head.
"Oh, my God," she sobbed, head in hand.
The two surviving planes were climbing out of sight. Smoke rose from fires in the town, smelling of burning hay. To the east, the two tank unit tracks had almost joined in a black V, miles long, across the plain. Pug righted the binoculars. Through smoke, billowing in the line of vision, he saw the tanks milling in a wild little yellow flashing vortex on the broad white plain. Five of the KV monsters bulged among lighter Russian tanks. Several German tanks were on fire, and their crewmen were running here and there in the snow like ants. Some German tanks and trucks were heading back to the woods. Pug saw only one light Russian tank giving off black smoke. But even as he watched, a KV burst into violent, beautiful purple-orange flame, casting a vivid pool of color on the snow. Meantime, the rest of the German tanks began turning away.
"Kitty! Oh, Christ! Christ, no! Stop it!"
Pam snatched up the cat, which was crouching over the dead man. She came to Pug, her tear-stained face gaunt and stunned, holding the creature in her arms. Its nose and whiskers were bloody, and its tongue flickered.
"It's not the animal's fault," she choked.
"The Russians are winning out there," Victor Henry said.
She was staring at him with blank, shocked, round eyes, clutching the black cat close to her. Her hand went to the rip at his shoulder.
"Dearest, are you hurt?"
"No, not at all. It went right on through."
"Thank God, thank God!"
The latter jumped and rapped, and Colonel Amfiteatrov's face, excited and red, showed at the top.
"Well, you're all right. Well, I'm glad. That was best to stay right here. The bombing was bad in the town. Many people killed. Quick, both of you, come along, please."
Then his eye fell on the body lying in blood.
"Ah."
"We were strafed," Pug said. "He's dead."
The colonel shook his head and sank out of sight, saying,
"Well, please, come quickly."
"Go first, Pam."
Pamela looked at the dead spotter, lying on the bricks in snow and blood, and then at the tin dome, and out at the tank fight, and the black V gouged in the landscape.
"It seems I've been up here for a week. I can't get down the ladder with the cat. We mustn't leave it here."
"Give the cat to me."
Tucking the animal inside his bridge coat, steadying it with one arm, Victor Henry awkwardly followed her down the ladder and the spiral stairs. Once the cat squirmed, bit, and scratched, and he almost fell. He turned the cat loose outside the church, but the clanking vehicles or the rolling smoke alarmed the animal, and it ran back in and vanished among the wounded. Through the open door of the black automobile, Tudsbury waved his cane at them.
"Hello! There's a monstrous tank battle going on just outside the town. They say there's at least 100 tanks swirling around, an utter inferno, happening right this minute. Hello, you've torn your coat, do you know that?"
"Yes, I know."
Though drained of spirit, Victor Henry was able to smile at the gap between journalism and war, as he detached his shoulder board and dropped it in his pocket. The reality of the two small groups of tanks banging away out there on the snowy plain seemed so pale and small-scale compared to Tudsbury's description.
"We had a view of it," he said.
Pamela got into the car and sank into a corner of the back seat, closing her eyes.
"Did you? Well, Pam ought to be a help on this story. I say, Pam, you're all right, aren't you?"
"I'm splendid, Talkie, thank you," Pam said, faintly but clearly.
Pug said to the colonel, "We saw the Germans starting to run."
"Good. Well, Kaplan's battalion got the word from down south. That is a good battalion."
Amfiteatrov slammed the car door.
"Make yourselves comfortable, please. We are going to drive straight back to Moscow now."
"Oh, no!"
Tudsbury's fat face wrinkled up like an infant's.
"I want to have a look when the fight's over. I want to interview the tank crews."
Amfiteatrov turned and faced them, and showed his gums and teeth without smiling. Behind him, through the frosted windshield, they could vaguely see, on the main street of the town, smoke, fire, a plunging horse, soldiers running, and green army trucks in a slow-moving jam.
"Well, there has been a very big breakthrough in the north. Moscow is in danger. Well, all foreign missions will be evacuated to the Caucasus. We must skedaddle."
He brought out the awkward slang word humorlessly and turned to the driver.
"Nu, skoro."
Under the blanket stretched across the passenger's legs, Pamela Tudsbury's gloved hand groped to Victor Henry's hand. She pulled off her glove, twined her cold fingers in his, and pressed her face against the torn shoulder of his bridge coat. His chapped hand tightened on hers. Chapter 56 Leslie Sloat heard footfalls in the dark as he sat in an overcoat and fur hat, working by the light of a kerosene lamp. His desk, overflowing with papers and reports, stood directly under the grand unlit chandelier in the marble-pillared great hall of Spaso House, the ambassador's Moscow residence. "Who's there?" The nervous, strident words reverberated in the empty halls. He recognized the white navy cap, white scarf, and brass buttons before he could make out the face. "Ye gods, Captain Henry, why didn't they take you straight to the Kazan station? Maybe you can still make it. You've got to get out of Moscow tonight."
"I've been to the station. The train to Kuibyshov had left."
Pug brushed snow from his shoulders.
"The air raid held us up outside the city."
Sloat looked at his wristwatch in great agitation. "But that's terrible. God knows when there'll be another train to Kuibyshov, if ever. Don't you know that one German armored column's already passed by to the north and is cutting down behind the city? And they say another pincer is heading up from Kaluga. One doesn't know what to believe anymore, but it's at least conceivable that in the next 24 hours we may be entirely surrounded. It begins to smell like Warsaw all over again." Sloat gaily laughed. "Sorry there are no chairs. A party of mad Georgian workmen came in and covered and stacked all the furniture. Oh, there's a stool, after all. Do sit down."
Pug said, "That's more than I know about the German pincers, and I've just come from the Narkomindel."
He sat down without opening his coat. It was almost as cold and dark in Spaso House as in the snowstorm outside. "Did you suppose they'd tell you anything? I got this straight from the Swedish ambassador, I assure you, at 9 o'clock tonight in the dining room at the Kazan station when I was seeing off the staff. My God, that station was a spectacle to remember. One bomb hit would have wiped out all the foreign correspondents and 9/10 of the diplomats in Russia, and a healthy chunk of the Soviet bureaucracy, too."
"Have all the typewriters been stowed? I have to write a report."
"There are typewriters in Colonel Yaten's office. I have a skeleton staff, and we're to keep things going somehow until the charge gets organized in Kuibyshov." Sloat gave this answer with absent-minded calm, then jumped at a muffled sound from outside. "Was that a bomb?" "You have no time to write reports, Captain. It's really my responsibility to see that you leave Moscow at once. And I must insist that somehow—" Pug held up a hand.
"The Nark's making arrangements. There are other stragglers like me.
I have to check back in at 11 in the morning.
Oh, well, if the Narco-Mendels assumed responsibility, that's that.
Sloat giggled. Victor Henry looked narrowly at him.
How come you got stuck with this duty again? It seems kind of thick after Warsaw.
I volunteered. You look skeptical. I truly did. After all, I've been through the drill. I wasn't too proud of the job I did in Warsaw, and I thought perhaps I could redeem myself this time.
Why? Byron told me you did a hell of a job in Warsaw, Leslie.
Did he?
Byron's a gentleman. A knight, almost. Which reminds me, an enormous pouch came in from Stockholm the day you left. There was stuff from Rome. Would you like to see a picture of your new grandson?
Fussing through papers on his desk, he pulled a photograph from a wrinkled envelope.
There he is. Don't you think he's handsome? The lamplight carved deep black marks in the naval officer's face as he read the writing on the back of the snapshot. For Old Sloat, Lewis Henry, aged 11 days, with circus fat lady, then contemplated the photograph. A plump, hollow-eyed Natalie in a loose robe held a baby that looked startlingly like Byron as an infant. The triangular face, the large, serious eyes, the comically determined look, the fine blonde hair, they were the same. Lewis was another print of the template that had molded his son. He was much more of a Henry than Janice's boy. Victor Henry cleared his choked-up throat.
Not bad. Natalie's right, she's gotten fat.
Hasn't she, though? Too much bed rest, she says. I'll bet the baby will be as clever as it's handsome. It looks clever.
Victor Henry sat staring at the snapshot. Sloat added, Would you care to keep that?
Henry at once extended it to him.
No, certainly not. She sent it to you.
I'll only lose it, Captain Henry. I have a better picture of Natalie.
Are you sure? All right.
Victor Henry tried to express, in an awkward smile, the gratitude for which he could find no words. Carefully, he put the print in an inner pocket.
What about the Tudsburys? Sloat asked. Are they stuck in Moscow, too?
I left Talkie trying to wangle a ride to Archangel for himself and Pam. The Russians are flying out some RAF pilot instructors. I'm sure he'll get on that plane.
Good. Did you run into any trouble at the front? What an idiocy, dragging a girl out there.
Well, we heard some firing and saw some Germans.
I'd better get at this report. If Talkie does fly out, I want to give him a copy to forward via London.
Let me have a copy, too, won't you? And another to go in the next pouch, if there is one.
You're a pessimist, Sloat.
I'm a realist. I was in Warsaw. I know what the Germans can do.
Do you know what the Russians can do?
I thought I did. I was the Red Army's biggest booster in the embassy until...
Sloat shrugged and turned to his desk, blowing his nose.
The only thing that really gets me is this stink of burning paper. My God, how it brings back Warsaw. The embassy absolutely reeks. We were burning and burning today until the minute they all left. And there's still a ton that I've somehow got to get burned in the morning.
All Moscow stinks of it, Pug said.
It's the damnedest thing to drive through a snowstorm and smell burned paper. The city's one unholy mess, Sloat. Have you seen all the barbed wire and tangled steel girders blocking the bridges? And good Lord, the mob at that railway station. The traffic jams heading east with headlights blazing. Blackout be damned. I didn't know there were that many trucks and cars in the whole Soviet Union. All piled with mattresses and old people and babies and what all. And with those blue AA searchlights still swinging overhead, God knows why, and the snow and the wind, I tell you, it's a real end-of-the-world feeling.
Sloat chuckled.
Yes, isn't it? This exodus began the day you left. It's been snowballing.
A convoy of government bigshots left yesterday in a line of honking black limousines. Gad, you should have seen the faces of the people along the streets. I'm sure that triggered this panic. However, I give Stalin credit. He's staying on to the last, and that takes courage, because when Hitler catches Stalin, he'll just hang him, like a dog in Red Square. And he'll drag Lenin's mummy out of the tomb, too, and string it up alongside to crumble in the wind. Oh, there'll be stirring things to see and record here, for whoever survives to tell it all. Victor Henry rose.
Do you know there's no sentry at the door? I just walked in.
That's impossible. We're guarded night and day by a soldier assigned by the Narcomindel.
There's nobody there.
Sloat opened and closed his mouth twice. Are you positive? Why, we could be sacked by looters. It's getting near the end when soldiers leave their posts. I must call the Narcomindel, if I can get the operator to answer. He jumped up and disappeared into the gloom. Victor Henry groped to the military attaché's office. There he struck matches and found and lit two kerosene lamps. In their bleak yellow-green glow, he surveyed the office. Bits of black ash flecked the floor and every surface. Burn, urgent, was scrawled in red crayon on manila folders topping heaps of reports, files, and loose papers piled on the floor and in the leather armchair. Empty drawers and files stood open. A swivel chair was overturned. The place looked as though it had been robbed. On the desk, on a typewriter with bunched, tangled keys, a message was propped, printed in block letters on torn cardboard. Imperative,